The transport Valkyrie's engine screamed through the sulfurous atmosphere of Kalos Prime as I gripped the restraint harness, watching the scarred landscape roll beneath us through the cracked viewport. Industrial towers jutted from the planet's surface like broken teeth, their smokestacks belching black clouds that merged with the perpetual overcast sky. This mining world had been feeding the Imperium's war machine for 3 centuries, but now its foundries served a darker purpose. The 47th Vestroian Firstborn had been locked in trench warfare here for 8 months, bleeding themselves dry against traitor guard forces who had embraced the ruinous powers. The pilot's voice crackled through the vox, informing me we were approaching the landing zone. Below, I could make out the zigzag pattern of defensive trenches carved into the rust-colored earth, stretching toward the horizon like infected wounds. Artillery craters pocked the no-man's land between the opposing forces, filled with stagnant water that reflected the sickly yellow glow of the planet's sun. The acrid smell of promethium exhaust and something far worse seeped through the cabin's air recyclers. My orders were clear. Command had grown tired of the 47th's lack of progress and deteriorating discipline. Reports spoke of units refusing direct orders, of guardsmen abandoning their posts, of whispered conversations about surrender. The regiment needed a firm hand, and I intended to provide exactly that. The previous commissar had died 3 weeks ago, reportedly from a sniper's last round, though the circumstances remained suspiciously vague in the official reports. As the Valkyrie touched down in a cloud of dust and debris, I gathered my gear and stepped onto the makeshift landing pad. The stench hit me immediately, unwashed bodies, rotting rations, and the sweet corruption of unburied dead. Guardsmen nearby barely acknowledged my arrival, their eyes hollow and unfocused. Their uniforms hung loose on gaunt frames, and their weapons showed signs of poor maintenance. This was worse than I had anticipated. Colonel Thaddeus Corvin approached across the muddy ground, his own uniform bearing the telltale signs of extended field service. Dark circles ringed his eyes, and his usually pristine Vestroian mustache had grown unkempt. He briefed me on the tactical situation with the weary tone of a man who had repeated the same hopeless assessment too many times. The enemy held the high ground around the primary mining complex, their positions reinforced with captured Imperial equipment. Every assault had been repelled with heavy casualties, and morale had reached critical levels. That evening, I made my first inspection of the forward trenches. The conditions were abysmal. Guardsmen huddled in dugouts carved from the trench walls, sharing body heat and stale rations. Many had removed their helmets despite standing orders, their hair matted with dirt and grease. Last guns lay propped against sandbags, their power packs dim or completely drained. The smell of human waste mixed with the metallic tang of spilled blood created an atmosphere of despair that seemed to seep into the very earth. I observed the men carefully as I walked the trench lines, noting which ones avoided eye contact and which ones whispered among themselves after I passed. Fear was a useful tool, but it needed to be the right kind of fear of failure, fear of disappointing the Emperor, fear of the consequences of cowardice. What I saw here was the wrong kind of fear, the kind that paralyzed rather than motivated. Sergeant Mikhail Volkov commanded 3rd Squad, and his men clearly respected him. I watched as he distributed the evening's rations with careful attention to each guardsman's needs, ensuring the wounded received extra portions while maintaining discipline without resorting to threats. The men responded to his quiet authority with genuine loyalty, something that had become increasingly rare in this regiment. Unfortunately, loyalty to individual leaders often came at the expense of loyalty to proper Imperial doctrine. The next morning brought news of another failed reconnaissance mission. 2 squads had been sent to probe enemy positions during the pre-dawn hours, but only 4 men had returned. The survivors reported that the traitor forces had somehow anticipated their movement, setting up ambush positions that decimated the patrol before it could gather useful intelligence. Worse, the returning guardsmen spoke of strange symbols carved into the enemy fortifications and the sound of blasphemous chanting echoing across the battlefield. Colonel Corvin called for an immediate staff meeting to discuss the situation. The assembled officers looked haggard and defeated, their tactical discussions focused more on minimizing losses than achieving objectives. When Lieutenant Castor suggested a strategic withdrawal to more defensible positions, several other officers nodded in agreement. The rot had spread even to the command structure. I listened to their defeatist proposals with growing disgust. These men had forgotten their purpose, forgotten their duty to the Emperor and the Imperium. They spoke of tactical flexibility and preserving manpower as if these concepts could justify abandoning their sacred mission. The mining facilities of Kalos Prime were too strategically important to abandon, and the precedent of retreat would only encourage further weakness throughout the sector. That afternoon, I announced my first major decision as the regiment's commissar. A frontal assault would commence at dawn, with all available companies participating in a coordinated attack on the enemy's primary defensive line. The objective was simple: break through their positions and secure the main mining complex within 48 hours. No exceptions, no excuses, no retreat. The reaction among the officers was immediate and predictable. They raised concerns about insufficient artillery support, inadequate intelligence on enemy strength, and the likelihood of massive casualties. Sergeant Volkov stepped forward and respectfully questioned the wisdom of such a direct approach, suggesting that his men needed time to recover from recent losses and that alternative strategies might prove more effective. His words carried weight with the other guardsmen present, and I could see doubt spreading through their ranks like a disease. This was exactly the kind of thinking that had brought the regiment to its current sorry state. Individual opinions and personal concerns had no place in military decision-making. The Emperor's will was clear, and my duty was to ensure that will was carried out regardless of personal cost. The execution took place at sunset, with the entire regiment assembled in the central command area. Volkov knelt in the mud, his hands bound behind his back, while I read the charges against him. Cowardice in the face of the enemy, undermining military discipline. Spreading defeatist sentiment among the ranks, each accusation was met with silence from the assembled guardsmen, though I could feel their hatred burning like acid in the air around us. My bolt pistol's report echoed across the camp, followed by the wet sound of Volkov's body hitting the ground. The men dispersed quickly after that, returning to their positions with new understanding of what would be expected from them. Several guardsmen had to be ordered away from the body, and I made note of their names for future reference. The assault began as scheduled, with three companies advancing across the killing ground toward enemy positions. La's fire lit up the pre-dawn darkness as the traitors responded with devastating accuracy, cutting down guardsmen in neat rows as they struggled through the mud and razor wire. The attack stalled within the first hour, leaving hundreds of bodies scattered across no man's land while the survivors cowered in shell craters and abandoned trenches. I watched the carnage unfold from the command bunker, noting which units had failed to maintain their advance and which officers had allowed their men to seek cover without authorization. The casualty reports painted a grim picture, over 60% losses in the first wave alone, with minimal ground gained and no significant damage to enemy positions. By any tactical measure, the assault had been a complete failure, but tactical considerations were secondary to matters of discipline and morale. The guardsmen had followed orders despite their personal fears and doubts. They had charged into certain death because their commissar had commanded it, and that obedience was worth more than any tactical victory. The survivors would remember this lesson, and their future performance would reflect this new understanding of imperial discipline. The days following the failed assault brought a subtle change to the regiment's atmosphere. Conversations became more guarded, with guardsmen speaking in hushed tones when they thought I might be listening. Orders were followed without question or delay, though I detected an underlying current of resentment that would need careful monitoring. Fear was beginning to replace despair, which represented definite progress toward proper military discipline. My quarters in the command bunker provided an excellent vantage point for observing the men's behavior during off-duty hours. Through the reinforced window, I could watch guardsmen moving between positions, noting their posture and interactions. Those who had served under Volkov were particularly interesting to observe, as they struggled to adapt to new leadership styles while processing their grief and anger. The Schola Progenium had prepared me well for this kind of psychological warfare. My instructors had emphasized that a commissar's authority derived not from popularity or personal charisma, but from the absolute certainty that imperial law would be enforced regardless of personal cost. Weakness in any form, hesitation, compromise, sympathy, would undermine that authority and ultimately lead to military collapse. I remembered Instructor Malthorn's lessons about the nature of fear and respect in military hierarchies. A commissar who sought to be liked by his men had already failed in his primary duty. The guardsmen needed to understand that their commissar existed outside their normal social structures, as an agent of imperial will who could not be influenced by personal appeals or emotional manipulation. This separation was essential for maintaining proper discipline under extreme conditions. Late that night, while reviewing casualty reports and planning the next day's operations, I began hearing strange sounds through the command bunker's vox system. At first, they seemed like normal communications chatter, routine status reports, and guard rotations. But gradually, I noticed an unusual pattern in the transmissions. Voices spoke of judgment and retribution, of accounts that would soon come due. The words were subtle, woven into otherwise normal conversations in ways that might have been coincidental. A guardsman reporting on ammunition supplies would mention that bullets had a way of finding their intended targets. Another would comment on how the dead sometimes had the last word in military matters. Taken individually, these statements were meaningless. Together, they suggested a coordinated effort to undermine my authority through psychological pressure. Enemy infiltration of Imperial Vox networks was a well-documented tactic, particularly among chaos-corrupted forces who specialized in sowing discord and doubt among loyal troops. The traitor guard units on Kalos Prime had demonstrated considerable tactical sophistication, and it made sense that they would attempt to exploit the regiment's low morale through targeted propaganda campaigns. I made detailed notes of each suspicious transmission, cross-referencing the voices with personnel records and duty rosters. Most of the speakers could be identified as specific guardsmen within the regiment, though their words seemed subtly different from their normal speech patterns. The content was designed to prey on existing fears and resentments, amplifying the natural tension that followed any disciplinary action. The paranoia was a natural response to command responsibility in a hostile environment. Every commissar learned to distinguish between legitimate security concerns and the psychological pressure that came with making life and death decisions for hundreds of men. My training had included extensive preparation for exactly this kind of mental stress, and I was confident in my ability to maintain proper judgment despite external influences. As the night wore on, the whispers seemed to grow more frequent and more specific. Voices spoke of Volkov's execution with detailed knowledge that should have been restricted to witnesses. They described the fear in his eyes and the way his body had twitched after the bolt round tore through his skull. Most disturbing were the references to other deaths that had not yet occurred, spoken with the certainty of established fact. The morning after my first execution brought an unusual stillness to the forward positions. I made my customary inspection rounds through the trench network, noting how the guardsmen's behavior had shifted overnight. Where previously they had slouched against sandbags or gathered in small groups, now they maintained rigid postures and avoided clustering together. The change was exactly what I had hoped to achieve, yet something felt wrong about the quality of their attention. During my walk through the communication trench leading to the eastern flank, I caught glimpses of movement in my peripheral vision. Quick flashes of familiar uniforms ducking behind cover or disappearing around corners just ahead of my position. Each time I turned to investigate, I found only empty stretches of muddy trench walls and abandoned firing positions. The phenomenon occurred repeatedly throughout the morning, always just at the edge of my sight, always vanishing when I focused my attention directly on the movement. The logical explanation was simple enough. Guardsmen were avoiding contact with their commissar, using their knowledge of patrol routes and timing to stay out of my path. Such behavior was natural after a public execution, as the men processed their fear and adjusted to new disciplinary standards. I made mental notes of which sections seemed most frequently abandoned during my inspections, planning to vary my routes to catch any guardsmen shirking their duties. By midday, reports began filtering back from the forward observation posts about strange discoveries in the overnight positions. Three guardsmen had been found dead in their bunker during the morning relief rotation, their bodies showing no visible wounds or signs of struggle. The corpses lay in their bedrolls as if they had died peacefully in their sleep, but their faces were frozen in expressions of absolute terror that suggested anything but peaceful deaths. I examined the bodies personally, searching for evidence of enemy action or sabotage. The bunker showed no signs of forced entry, and their weapons remained untouched beside their sleeping positions. No chemical residue or unusual odors suggested poison gas attacks, and the men's equipment was arranged exactly as it should be for a normal rest period. The only unusual detail was the temperature. The bunker felt significantly colder than the surrounding trenches, despite being sealed against the elements. My initial assessment pointed toward cowardly suicide pacts among men who lacked the courage to face continued combat operations. Such incidents were not uncommon in prolonged siege warfare, particularly when discipline had been allowed to deteriorate to the extent I had witnessed in the 47th. The terror on their faces could easily be explained by the final moments of consciousness as whatever poison or method they had chosen took effect. The regimental medic provided no useful insights during his examination of the bodies. He confirmed the absence of obvious wounds or toxins, but admitted his field equipment was insufficient for detailed analysis of more subtle causes of death. His nervous manner and reluctance to speculate about the deaths suggested he was hiding information, possibly to protect other guardsmen involved in the suicide conspiracy. I ordered enhanced security measures for all forward positions, including mandatory buddy system protocols and random inspections throughout the night hours. Any guardsmen found alone or in unauthorized locations would face immediate disciplinary action. The message was clear. Whatever cowardly schemes were spreading through the ranks would be crushed before they could undermine military effectiveness. That afternoon brought another incident that demanded swift response. A young Vox operator named Dmitry Kozlov approached his squad leader with claims about hearing voices through his communication equipment. According to the report, he insisted that dead comrades were speaking to him through the static, providing warnings about upcoming attacks and revealing information about enemy positions that he could not possibly have known through normal channels. The squad leader had initially dismissed these claims as combat stress or equipment malfunction, but Kozlov became increasingly agitated throughout the day. He began refusing to use his Vox equipment for normal communications, claiming that the voices of the dead were growing louder and more insistent. By evening, he was openly stating that Sergeant Volkov was speaking to him through the radio, demanding vengeance for his unjust execution. Such behavior could not be tolerated under any circumstances. Kozlov's claims represented a direct challenge to military authority and a dangerous example of the kind of superstitious thinking that could spread like wildfire through demoralized troops. His references to Volkov were particularly problematic, as they suggested an organized effort to undermine the legitimacy of necessary disciplinary actions. I convened an immediate field tribunal to address the charges against Kozlov. The evidence was overwhelming. Multiple witnesses confirmed his refusal to follow orders and his public statements about supernatural communications. His own squad leader testified about the Vox operator's increasingly erratic behavior and his disruptive influence on unit cohesion. The execution took place at sunset, with Kozlov's own communication equipment arranged nearby as a reminder of how quickly technical problems could become disciplinary issues. I made sure every guardsman in the vicinity understood that claims of supernatural intervention would be treated as evidence of cowardice and defeatism. The Emperor's light was the only spiritual force that loyal Imperial soldiers needed to acknowledge. The reaction among the men was more subdued this time, though I detected an undercurrent of something that went beyond simple fear. Several guardsmen stared at me with expressions that seemed almost calculating, as if they were measuring some invisible quality that I could not identify. Others avoided looking in my direction entirely, focusing their attention on the ground or the horizon with unnatural intensity. Colonel Corvin approached me after the formation dispersed, his manner more formal and distant than during our previous interactions. He acknowledged the necessity of maintaining discipline while expressing concern about the regiment's overall morale and combat effectiveness. His words were carefully chosen and technically correct, but his tone suggested significant reservations about my methods. The other officers displayed similar patterns of behavior over the following days. They continued to follow orders and maintain proper military courtesy, but their interactions with me became increasingly brief and professional. Conversations that should have included tactical discussions or strategic planning were reduced to essential information exchanges with minimal elaboration or personal input. This isolation was a predictable consequence of enforcing proper discipline in a unit that had been allowed to operate with excessive familiarity between ranks. The officers needed time to adjust to working with a commissar who took his duties seriously, rather than someone who might compromise imperial law for the sake of personal popularity. Their discomfort was a small price to pay for restoring proper military hierarchy. My sleep became increasingly disrupted during this period, filled with vivid dreams that featured the faces of executed guardsmen. The images were remarkably detailed, showing Volkov and Kozlov exactly as they had appeared during their final moments, down to specific expressions and physical positions. In these dreams, their mouths moved constantly, forming words that I could not quite hear but somehow understood were accusations and condemnations. The dreams felt different from normal subconscious processing of recent events. They carried a weight and intensity that seemed to persist even after waking, leaving me with lingering impressions of conversations that had never actually occurred. Most disturbing was the consistency of the imagery, the same faces appearing night after night, always with the same expressions of betrayed trust and righteous anger. I recognized these symptoms as manifestations of command stress, exacerbated by the isolation inherent in commissar duties and the psychological pressure of making difficult decisions under combat conditions. The Schola Progenium had prepared me for exactly this kind of mental challenge, emphasizing that a commissar's resolve would be tested not only by external enemies, but by his own conscience attempting to undermine necessary actions. The solution was to maintain focus on duty and imperial law rather than dwelling on personal feelings or regrets. Every execution had been justified by clear violations of military discipline, and any emotional response to carrying out these sentences was a weakness that needed to be suppressed. The Emperor's service demanded sacrifice from all his servants, including the sacrifice of personal comfort and peace of mind. Additional deaths began occurring with disturbing regularity throughout the following week. Guardsmen were discovered in various states of unexplained demise, some found frozen in their positions despite the planet's moderate climate, others discovered with their weapons aimed at empty air as if they had been firing at invisible targets until their power packs were completely drained. The pattern was becoming impossible to ignore, though the cause remained frustratingly unclear. Medical examinations continued to reveal no obvious wounds or toxins, while equipment inspections showed no signs of sabotage or mechanical failure. The only consistent factor was the expression of absolute terror found on every victim's face, suggesting they had experienced something profoundly frightening in their final moments. My investigation into these incidents revealed several troubling details about the timing and circumstances of each death. Most occurred during the pre-dawn hours when visibility was poorest and guard rotations were changing. The victims were invariably found in positions that should have been secure, with their equipment and personal effects undisturbed except for the inexplicable temperature drops that seemed to accompany each discovery. Enemy infiltration remained the most logical explanation, despite the lack of physical evidence supporting this theory. Chaos corrupted forces were known to employ exotic weapons and psychological warfare techniques that could produce exactly these kinds of mysterious casualties. The traitor guard units on Kalos Prime had already demonstrated sophisticated tactical capabilities, and it was reasonable to assume they possessed specialized equipment for conducting covert operations. I ordered increased patrols and enhanced security protocols for all forward positions, with particular attention to the areas where deaths had occurred. Guardsmen were instructed to report any unusual sounds, temperature changes, or equipment malfunctions immediately, regardless of how insignificant they might seem. The enemy's psychological warfare campaign would be countered with improved vigilance and rapid response to any suspicious activity. The men's behavior continued to evolve in ways that suggested the disciplinary measures were having their intended effect. Conversations became more focused on duty assignments and tactical concerns, with less time wasted on personal matters or idle speculation. Orders were executed with prompt efficiency, and complaints about living conditions or combat assignments virtually disappeared from the daily reports. However, I began noticing that guardsmen would sometimes pause in their activities when they thought I was not observing them directly. They would stand perfectly still for several seconds, their heads tilted slightly as if listening to sounds that I could not hear. When questioned about these incidents, they invariably claimed to have been concentrating on distant artillery fire or trying to identify mechanical sounds from enemy positions. The quality of their attention during these episodes was distinctly different from normal battlefield awareness. Their posture suggested they were receiving specific information rather than simply monitoring their environment for potential threats. Most unsettling was the way their eyes would track movement in empty spaces, following invisible objects with the kind of focused precision normally reserved for actual targets. My own peripheral vision began registering similar phenomena during routine inspections and administrative duties. Shadows seemed to move independently of their sources, and I occasionally caught glimpses of figures standing in positions where no guardsmen were supposed to be present. Each time I investigated these sightings directly, I found only empty trenches and abandoned equipment, yet the impression of observed presence remained uncomfortably strong. The logical explanation involved fatigue and the cumulative stress of command responsibility in hostile conditions. Extended periods of high alertness combined with irregular sleep patterns could easily produce minor hallucinations and heightened sensitivity to environmental stimuli. Such symptoms were well documented among military personnel operating under extreme conditions, and they typically resolved themselves once proper rest and routine were reestablished. I began maintaining more detailed records of these incidents, noting the specific times, locations, and circumstances of each occurrence. The pattern that emerged suggested a correlation with the sites where unexplained deaths had taken place, though this could simply reflect my increased attention to those particular areas rather than any genuine supernatural connection. The faces in my dreams became more numerous and more detailed as additional executions became necessary to maintain proper discipline. A guardsman caught sleeping on watch joined the nightly procession of accusatory stairs. Another, who had been overheard questioning the strategic value of continued offensive operations, added his silent condemnation to the growing crowd of spectral judges that populated my subconscious mind. Each new face carried the same expression of betrayed trust and righteous anger, their mouths moving in synchronized patterns that suggested coordinated communication rather than individual protests. The dreams began extending beyond simple visual imagery to include tactile sensations, the feeling of cold breath on my neck, the pressure of invisible hands grasping at my uniform, the weight of unseen bodies pressing against me from all sides. These manifestations represented my mind's attempt to process the psychological burden of command decisions through symbolic imagery. The fact that the dreams were becoming more vivid and more frequent indicated that my subconscious was struggling to reconcile necessary actions with ingrained emotional responses, but this was a normal part of adapting to commissar responsibilities. The solution was to maintain unwavering focus on duty and imperial law while refusing to acknowledge any emotional significance in these psychological phenomena. Every guardsman I had executed had violated clear military regulations, and their deaths had been necessary to preserve unit cohesion and combat effectiveness. Any guilt or regret I might experience was a weakness that needed to be suppressed for the greater good of the regiment and the Imperium. The night assault began under a starless sky, with the 47th advancing through the industrial ruins toward the traitor positions on the eastern ridge. I led the charge alongside Captain Thorne's company, my chainsword humming with eager anticipation as we moved through the twisted metal wreckage of abandoned mining equipment. The air tasted of rust and decay, thick with the acrid smoke that perpetually shrouded Kalos Prime's scarred landscape. La's fire erupted from the enemy trenches as our advance was detected, crimson beams cutting through the darkness like angry insects. The guardsmen around me pressed forward with grim determination, their earlier reluctance replaced by the kind of focused aggression that proper discipline could instill. I felt a surge of satisfaction watching them charge into the killing zone without hesitation, their fear of my bolt pistol now outweighing their fear of enemy fire. The assault fragmented quickly as we encountered unexpected resistance from concealed positions. Heavy bolter nests opened up from flanking positions that our reconnaissance had missed, forcing the companies to split into smaller units and seek cover among the industrial debris. I found myself separated from the main force, leading a handful of guardsmen through a maze of collapsed storage tanks and twisted girders. The shrine appeared through the smoke like a monument to forgotten faith. Its Gothic architecture stood in stark contrast to the industrial wasteland surrounding it, black stone walls rising toward pointed spires that disappeared into the perpetual overcast. Stained glass windows depicted scenes of imperial triumph, though many of the panes had been shattered by artillery fire or neglect. The massive doors hung open, revealing darkness that seemed to swallow our lamplight. My small group took shelter inside as enemy fire intensified around our position. The interior was vast and cold, with rows of wooden pews facing an altar dedicated to the God Emperor's glory. Dust motes danced in the weak light filtering through broken windows, and our footsteps echoed strangely in the vaulted space. The air felt thick and oppressive, carrying scents of incense and something else that reminded me unpleasantly of the morgue tents behind our lines. The guardsmen with me began expressing concerns about strange sounds echoing from the deeper recesses of the shrine. They claimed to hear footsteps and whispered conversations coming from areas where no one else was present, though I detected nothing beyond the normal settling sounds of an old building under bombardment. Their nervousness was understandable given the circumstances, but I made note of which men seemed most affected by imaginary threats. As the night wore on, I realized our Vox equipment had been damaged during the assault, cutting us off from regimental command and leaving us isolated in enemy territory. The tactical situation was far from ideal, but the shrine provided defensible positions and clear fields of fire from its elevated windows. We would hold this position until dawn brought relief or opportunity to rejoin the main force. The shadows began moving incorrectly sometime after midnight. I first noticed the phenomenon while checking the perimeter defenses, observing how darkness seemed to flow independently of the lamplight we had positioned throughout the building. Shadows would stretch and contract without corresponding changes in illumination, creating the illusion of movement where none should exist. The effect was most pronounced near the altar area, where carved stone figures of imperial saints seemed to shift position when viewed from different angles. Their faces appeared to track my movement across the shrine's interior, stone eyes following me with expressions that grew increasingly hostile as the night progressed. The phenomenon was clearly an optical illusion caused by fatigue and irregular lighting, but the consistency of the effect was unsettling. My name began echoing through the shrine's corridors, whispered by voices I recognized but could not place. The sound seemed to originate from multiple directions simultaneously, creating an acoustic confusion that made it impossible to identify specific sources. Each repetition carried different emotional undertones, sometimes pleading, sometimes accusatory, sometimes filled with rage that made my skin crawl. The voices belonged to guardsmen from my own regiment, though their words were distorted by echoes and distance in ways that made individual identification difficult. They spoke my name with intimate familiarity, as if we had shared conversations and experiences that I could not quite remember. The tone suggested knowledge of secrets and failures that I had never revealed to anyone. Sergeant Volkov's voice emerged from the shadows near the altar, speaking with the same calm authority he had displayed during life. His words carried across the shrine's interior with perfect clarity, describing my cowardice during my first combat deployment on Mordian Tertius 15 years earlier. He recounted details that no one else could possibly know, how I had hidden behind a supply crate while my squad leader died calling for support, how I had claimed equipment malfunction to explain my failure to advance with the assault wave. The accuracy of these revelations was impossible to explain through normal means. Volkov had never served on Mordian Tertius, and my service records from that deployment had been classified and sealed according to standard protocols. No living person knew about my moment of weakness during that first engagement, yet the voice in the darkness recited every shameful detail with perfect precision. More voices joined the accusatory chorus as spectral figures began materializing throughout the shrine's interior. The guardsmen I had executed appeared one by one, their forms translucent but clearly recognizable. They wore the same uniforms they had died in, complete with the bolt wounds that had ended their lives. Their faces bore expressions of righteous anger mixed with profound disappointment, as if they had expected better from someone sworn to serve the Emperor. Young Dmitry Kozlov stepped forward from behind a stone pillar, his Vox equipment still strapped to his back and sparking with unnatural energy. His mouth moved in silent accusation before his voice filled the shrine with condemnations of my methods and motivations. He spoke of the fear I had cultivated among the guardsmen, describing how my reign of terror had destroyed unit cohesion rather than strengthening it. The ghostly Vox operator detailed my secret doubts about Imperial doctrine and my growing addiction to the power that came with holding life and death authority over other men. He described nights when I had lain awake planning which guardsmen to execute next, selecting victims based on personal dislike rather than actual violations of military law. His words painted a picture of systematic abuse disguised as righteous enforcement of discipline. Each accusation struck with the force of absolute truth, revealing aspects of my behavior that I had hidden even from myself. The spectral guardsmen knew about my private moments of uncertainty, my growing pleasure in watching men die at my command, my deliberate misinterpretation of regulations to justify executions that served no military purpose. They spoke of corruption that went far deeper than simple abuse of authority. I drew my bolt pistol and fired at the nearest apparition, the explosive round passing harmlessly through Volkov's translucent form before detonating against the stone wall behind him. The sergeant's ghostly figure remained unmoved, continuing his litany of accusations while fragments of blessed stone scattered across the shrine's floor. My weapon's sanctified ammunition had no effect on these manifestations, suggesting they existed beyond the reach of conventional Imperial armaments. The chainsword roared to life as I swung at Kozlov's spectral form, the blessed teeth passing through his body without resistance. The young guardsman's image flickered but did not disperse, his voice growing louder as he described my deliberate sabotage of morale and unit effectiveness. The weapon that had served me faithfully in countless engagements against the Emperor's enemies was useless against these accusers from beyond death. More executed guardsmen emerged from the shadows, forming a circle around my position near the altar. Each one bore the wounds I had inflicted, their ghostly blood staining the shrine's ancient stones with dark accusations. They spoke in unison now, their voices blending into a chorus of condemnation that echoed from every surface of the sacred space. The temperature dropped noticeably as their numbers increased, my breath forming visible clouds in air that had been warm moments before. Frost began forming on the stained glass windows and stone surfaces, creating patterns that resembled the faces of additional victims I had yet to kill. The cold seemed to emanate from the spectral figures themselves, carrying the chill of the grave into the world of the living. My hands began to burn with intense cold as ghostly fingers grasped at my uniform and exposed skin. The touches left visible marks, red welts, and frostbite patterns that spread across my flesh despite the incorporeal nature of my attackers. Pain shot through my body as spectral hands found purchase on my arms and shoulders, their grip tightening with supernatural strength. The guardsmen I had killed began reciting a mockery of Imperial justice, their voices taking on the formal cadences of military tribunals and court proceedings. They listed my crimes against the Emperor's faithful servants with bureaucratic precision, describing each execution as murder rather than legitimate discipline. Their words transformed my righteous enforcement of Imperial law into a catalog of atrocities committed against loyal soldiers. Volkov assumed the role of chief prosecutor, his spectral form growing more solid and defined as he detailed the charges against me. He spoke of corruption of duty, abuse of authority, and betrayal of the sacred trust placed in commissars by the God Emperor himself. His accusations were supported by testimony from each executed guardsman, their voices providing evidence of systematic brutality disguised as military necessity. The trial proceeded with nightmarish efficiency, following Imperial legal procedures with perfect accuracy while reaching conclusions that inverted everything I understood about my service record. The ghostly tribunal found me guilty of crimes against humanity, dereliction of duty, and heretical abuse of imperial authority. Their verdict carried the weight of absolute certainty, pronounced by voices that could not be silenced or refuted. My attempts to defend myself were met with laughter from the spectral assembly. They knew my thoughts and motivations better than I knew them myself, anticipating every justification and excuse before I could voice them. The guardsmen I had killed possessed intimate knowledge of my psychological weaknesses and moral failures, using this information to dismantle my self-image with surgical precision. The shrine's architecture seemed to shift and change around us, walls stretching higher while the ceiling receded into darkness that swallowed our lamplight. The space became a vast courtroom where the dead sat in judgment of the living, their ghostly presence transforming the sacred building into a tribunal beyond imperial law. The altar became a judge's bench where my accusers pronounced sentence with divine authority. Kozlov's spectral form approached closer, his young face bearing wounds that had never had time to heal properly. He described the fear that had consumed the regiment's survivors, explaining how my methods had created an atmosphere of terror that paralyzed rather than motivated. His words revealed the true cost of my disciplinary measures, not improved performance, but psychological destruction of men who deserved better leadership. The Vox operator's ghost detailed the suicide packs that had formed among guardsmen desperate to escape my reign of terror. He named specific soldiers who had chosen death over continued service under my command, their bodies found in positions that suggested self-inflicted wounds rather than enemy action. My enforcement of discipline had driven loyal imperial servants to take their own lives rather than face another day of systematic brutality. Each revelation struck like a physical blow, forcing me to confront the reality of what I had become during my service with the 47th. The spectral guardsmen spoke truth that cut deeper than any chainsword, exposing the corruption that had grown within my soul like a cancer. Their accusations were not the ravings of cowards or traitors, but the righteous anger of faithful servants betrayed by someone sworn to protect them. The ghostly figures began pressing closer, their cold touch leaving increasingly severe injuries on my exposed flesh. Frostbite spread across my hands and face, while spectral fingers left bruises and cuts that bled real blood onto the shrine's ancient stones. The pain was overwhelming, yet I found myself unable to flee or fight back effectively against attackers who existed beyond the reach of physical weapons. My sanity began fragmenting under the weight of accumulated accusations and revelations. The careful mental disciplines taught by the Schola Progenium crumbled as ghostly voices exposed every hidden weakness and secret failure. The foundation of righteous certainty that had sustained me throughout my career dissolved into recognition of systematic abuse and corruption disguised as imperial service. The dead guardsmen knew about my childhood fears and adult inadequacies with the same precision they had demonstrated regarding my military failures. They spoke of loneliness and insecurity that had driven me to seek power over others, describing psychological patterns that had led inevitably to the atrocities I had committed in the Emperor's name. Their understanding was complete and merciless, leaving no aspect of my character unexposed. I awoke to the acrid smell of cordite and rotting flesh, my body sprawled across the cold stone floor of the shrine. The spectral tribunal had vanished, leaving only silence and the distant rumble of artillery that had become the constant soundtrack of this cursed world. My head throbbed with the intensity of a migraine, and when I touched my face, I found dried blood crusted around my nose and ears. The wounds from ghostly fingers had disappeared, leaving only faint marks that could have been bruises from falling unconscious. The rational explanation presented itself with welcome clarity. Combat stress had finally overwhelmed my mental defenses, producing vivid hallucinations that had felt completely real while I experienced them. The isolation, constant pressure of command decisions, and accumulated fatigue had triggered a psychological break that manifested as supernatural encounters with my victims. Such episodes were documented among commissars who had served too long in hostile conditions without proper rest or psychological support. I gathered my equipment and prepared to return to the regimental positions, eager to resume normal duties and put the disturbing experience behind me. The shrine's interior looked exactly as it had when we first sought shelter, with no evidence of the ghostly tribunal or supernatural phenomena I remembered so vividly. Even the temperature had returned to normal, though I noticed my breath still formed faint clouds in the morning air. The journey back through the industrial ruins revealed the aftermath of the night assault with brutal clarity. Bodies of guardsmen lay scattered among the twisted metal wreckage, their uniforms torn by shrapnel and Law's fire. The attack had clearly failed, with heavy casualties among the assault companies and no apparent gains against enemy positions. The sight of so many dead soldiers filled me with grim satisfaction that my disciplinary measures had at least ensured they died fighting rather than cowering in their trenches. But as I moved closer to examine the casualties, details began emerging that challenged my understanding of what had occurred during the night. The bodies showed no signs of enemy weapons fire or explosive damage. Instead, each corpse bore the same expression of absolute terror I had witnessed on the faces of guardsmen found dead in their bunkers over the previous weeks. Their eyes were wide with horror, mouths open in silent screams that suggested they had died from fear rather than physical wounds. More disturbing was the positioning of the bodies throughout the battlefield. Rather than lying where they had fallen during combat, the guardsmen were arranged in neat rows facing the shrine where I had spent the night. Their weapons lay beside them untouched, power packs still fully charged and ready for use. The scene resembled a mass execution more than the aftermath of a failed assault, though no enemy forces were visible anywhere in the area. I found Captain Thorne's body near the base of a collapsed storage tank, his face frozen in the same expression of terror that marked all the other casualties. His uniform was intact except for tears that appeared to have been made from the inside out, as if something had clawed its way through the fabric from within his chest. His bolt pistol remained holstered and unfired, suggesting he had died without even attempting to defend himself against whatever had killed him. The realization struck me with the force of a physical blow. Every guardsman who had participated in the night assault was dead, their bodies arranged in perfect formation, as if they had died simultaneously while standing at attention. The tactical impossibility of such casualties began to sink in as I counted over 300 corpses spread across the industrial wasteland, each one bearing identical expressions of supernatural terror. My Vox equipment crackled to life as I attempted to contact regimental headquarters, but only static and interference emerged from the speakers. The communication channels that should have connected me to Colonel Corvin and the command staff carried nothing but electronic noise punctuated by sounds that resembled distant screaming. Even the emergency frequencies reserved for critical situations produced only meaningless static that hurt my ears with its intensity. I began the long walk back toward our defensive lines, following the communication trenches and supply routes that connected the forward positions to the main encampment. The journey should have taken less than 2 hours, but the familiar landmarks seemed wrong somehow. Trenches appeared deeper and narrower than I remembered, while the angles of approach didn't match my mental map of the area. The first checkpoint should have been manned by at least a squad of guardsmen, but I found only empty sandbag positions and abandoned equipment. The heavy bolter emplacement that dominated this section of the defensive line sat unmanned, its barrel pointed skyward as if the crew had simply walked away in the middle of their duty shift. Personal belongings were scattered around the position, suggesting the occupants had left in considerable haste. Each subsequent checkpoint revealed the same pattern of abandonment. Weapons lay where they had been dropped, ration packs sat half-eaten beside cold cooking fires, and personal items were strewn across the ground as if their owners had fled without taking time to gather their possessions. The defensive positions that should have been bustling with activity stood empty and silent under the perpetual overcast sky. The silence was absolute and unnatural. No sounds of human activity reached my ears as I moved through the abandoned trenches. No conversations, no equipment maintenance, no routine military activities that should have filled the air with familiar noise. Even the constant background rumble of distant artillery had ceased, leaving only the sound of my own footsteps echoing off the trench walls. I reached the main command bunker as the sun reached its zenith, though the thick cloud cover made it difficult to judge the exact time. The fortified position that served as regimental headquarters stood empty, its blast doors hanging open to reveal darkened corridors beyond. The communication equipment that should have been manned around the clock sat silent, its screens dark and its Vox speakers producing only faint electronic hums. Colonel Corvin's office showed signs of hasty evacuation, with papers scattered across the floor and furniture overturned, as if someone had searched through everything in desperate haste. The regimental colors that normally hung behind his desk were gone, along with most of the tactical maps and operational documents that covered the walls. Only a few personal photographs remained, their subjects staring out with expressions that seemed accusatory in the dim light. The barracks areas revealed the same pattern of sudden abandonment. Bunks were unmade and personal belongings lay scattered across the floors, but no bodies were present to explain what had happened to the occupants. Lockers stood open with their contents spilling out, while letters from home and personal mementos were trampled underfoot as if their owners had fled in panic. I searched every section of the command complex, calling out for any surviving personnel who might be hiding in the deeper bunkers or storage areas. My voice echoed through empty corridors without receiving any response, the sound seeming to fade more quickly than it should in the enclosed spaces. The air grew colder as I ventured deeper into the complex, my breath forming visible clouds despite the underground location. The realization that I was completely alone began to sink in as I completed my search of the headquarters area, not just alone in the command bunker, but alone on the entire battlefield. Thousands of guardsmen had simply vanished, leaving behind only their equipment and the mysterious corpses from the failed night assault. The enemy forces that had occupied the eastern ridge were equally absent, their positions abandoned as thoroughly as our own. I climbed to the highest observation point available, using the command bunker's periscope system to scan the surrounding terrain for any signs of life. The industrial landscape stretched toward the horizon without revealing any movement or activity. No smoke rose from enemy positions, no vehicles moved along the supply routes, and no aircraft disturbed the oppressive silence that had settled over Kalos Prime like a burial shroud. The tactical situation made no sense according to any military doctrine I had studied. Entire armies did not simply disappear without leaving traces of their movement or destination. The logistics alone would have required massive transportation assets and coordination that should have been visible from orbital reconnaissance platforms. Yet the evidence of my own senses suggested that every living soul had vanished from the planet's surface except myself. My mind began cataloging the events that had led to this impossible situation, searching for rational explanations that could account for the mass disappearance of both friendly and enemy forces. The timeline suggested that whatever had occurred must have happened during my night in the shrine, while I was experiencing hallucinations brought on by combat stress and psychological breakdown. The possibility that my supernatural encounter had been real rather than imaginary forced itself into my consciousness despite my attempts to maintain rational analysis. If the ghostly tribunal had possessed actual power rather than existing only in my damaged psyche, then their verdict might have carried consequences that extended beyond personal judgment. The dead guardsmen had spoken of justice and retribution, of accounts that needed to be balanced according to imperial law. I found myself walking back toward the shrine without making a conscious decision to do so, my feet carrying me along the same route I had taken that morning, while my mind struggled to process the implications of my situation. The building stood exactly as I had left it, its Gothic architecture unmarked by the supernatural events I remembered experiencing within its walls. The interior felt different now, charged with an energy that made my skin crawl and my teeth ache. The air seemed thicker somehow, carrying scents of incense mixed with decay that reminded me of funeral rites and burial ceremonies. My footsteps echoed strangely in the vaulted space, creating harmonics that sounded almost like whispered conversations in languages I could not identify. The altar area drew my attention with magnetic force, though I could not explain why the carved stone figures seemed more lifelike than they had appeared previously. Their faces bore expressions of judgment and condemnation that tracked my movement across the shrine's interior, stone eyes following me with intelligence that should not have existed in lifeless sculptures. I knelt before the altar in a gesture of submission that felt both natural and terrifying. My commissar's training warring with instincts that demanded acknowledgement of powers beyond imperial authority. The cold stone pressed against my knees through the fabric of my uniform, while the weight of invisible observation pressed down on my shoulders like physical force. The understanding came gradually, seeping into my consciousness like poison through an open wound. My obsessive need to prove my worth through brutality had not strengthened the regiment, but destroyed it utterly. Every execution had been an act of cowardice disguised as duty. Every display of authority had been compensation for my own inadequacies and failures. The men I had killed were not cowards or traitors, but loyal servants of the Emperor who had deserved better leadership than I could provide. The Emperor's justice had indeed found me wanting, but not through any supernatural tribunal of ghostly accusers. The judgment had come through my own actions and their inevitable consequences, as the regiment I was sworn to protect disintegrated under the weight of systematic brutality and psychological terror. The disappearance of every living soul on Kalos Prime was not divine intervention, but the natural result of leadership that had forgotten its purpose. I drew my bolt pistol with hands that shook from more than physical exhaustion, the weapon's familiar weight providing no comfort in my final moments of clarity. The blessed ammunition that had ended so many lives would now serve its final purpose, delivering the justice that imperial law demanded for crimes against the Emperor's faithful servants. My finger tightened on the trigger as I pressed the barrel against my temple. The laughter began as I squeezed the trigger, echoing from every surface of the shrine with the voices of men I had murdered in the name of duty. Volkov's chuckle mixed with Kozlov's bitter amusement, while dozens of other executed guardsmen added their mirth to the chorus that filled the sacred space. The sound carried notes of satisfaction and vindication, as if my final act was exactly what they had been waiting to witness. The bolt pistol's firing mechanism clicked empty, the weapon's machine spirit refusing to grant me the mercy of quick death. I pulled the trigger repeatedly, desperation growing as each attempt produced only the hollow sound of an empty chamber. The laughter grew louder with each failed attempt, the voices of my victims celebrating my inability to escape the consequences of my actions. I was trapped in a hell of my own creation, surrounded by the echoes of innocent blood spilled in service to my own inadequacies and fears. The isolation that had seemed like temporary punishment revealed itself as eternal sentence, a judgment that would persist beyond death and into whatever afterlife awaited servants who had betrayed their sacred trust. The Emperor's justice was perfect and inescapable, delivered through the voices of the faithful dead who would never allow me to forget what I had become.